Hello there, listener. You are very welcome to episode 74 of Good Copy, Bad Copy, the B2B copywriting podcast. This month, we're talking about how and why to use research to improve your B2B content. My name's David Maguire. I'm creative director at Radix Communications. And as ever, I'm joined by our CEO, Fiona Campbell-Howes.
Hello.
Hi, Fiona. How's your week been?
Might be best not to ask about that. Well, it's been very busy, hasn't it? Things are humming.
It's been off the chain hook chain.
Off the chain hook chain, yes, yes. Although I would like to reassure our listeners that this time we're not high on solvents.
Speak for yourself.
Where are we? Who knows?
In a moment, we'll hear from Simon Hayhurst from B2B marketing researchers Coleman Parks, and we'll hear his top tips for carrying out the kind of research that leads to great content. If you have any questions or comments, hit us up. Email us at podcast@radix-communications.com or tweet us at radixcom. That's RADIXCOM. Original research can make all the difference to your content marketing. In fact, Andy Crestodina of Orbit Media says primary research is the one kind of content that crushes almost everything else you can publish. But how do you do it well? How many people do you need to talk to and what do you ask? I caught up with B2B research expert Simon Hayhurst of Coleman Parks to get the inside track. Simon, thank you for joining us. I was wondering if you could start by sort of telling our listener a little bit about you and about Coleman Parks and what it is you do.
Okay. So, yeah, Coleman Parks are a UK-based specialist business-to-business research agency. So we don't tend to research people's favourite brand of mayonnaise. It's more about the issues that affect businesses directly and the business people that they talk to. We often think that business-to-business marketing is chess to consumer-based marketing drafts, if you like, because there are so many different people that are involved in the decision-making process, and it's so difficult to isolate who the key people are and what you need to say to them and when in order to get them to choose your product or your idea ahead of anyone else's. So I've been doing this for many years now, and it's absolutely fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
I bet it is. I bet it is. So what sort of research do you do, and who do you do it for?
Okay, well, we do a range of qualitative and quantitative research. We're a roster agency for many top communications agencies, the likes of Grist, Harvard, Edelman, Man Bites Dog, Golin, as well as direct clients like Accenture and PwC and Capgemini. And our agency's clients, end clients, include the likes of KPMG and Xerox and LinkedIn. So a lot of business-to-business clients, especially in fast-moving verticals like technology.
Okay, and the research that you do for them, is that around sort of what their customers want and what their kind of marketing proposals and their content should be, or is it also kind of research that they can then use in their own content marketing?
So about 40% of what we do is what you might call thought leadership stroke content marketing research, where they're ultimately wanting to make the insights that we get public, with their name at the bottom saying, we commissioned an independent research agency to go away and find out X, and this is what they discovered. And the fact that they commissioned the research obviously means that it's most helpful to them in terms of positioning their particular product or idea best in the eyes of the people they're trying to reach.
Okay. And so for example, I mean, getting really meta about it. So that's the kind of research that you did. I think you did a piece with Grist, didn't you? So that was thought leadership research about thought leadership research.
Yeah. About a year ago, we spoke to well over 500 people in the C-suite. So CTOs, CEOs, CFOs, COOs globally, to find out how they consume thought leadership, when they turn to it, how they use it, when they read it, what they like, what they don't like. And that research is really powerful, and it has helped influence what a lot of our own clients do when they're doing research for their own thought leadership from then on.
So, I mean, could you briefly sort of say what you found? Was there kind of a strong argument in that for actually including original research in your own B2B content?
I think there were three key themes that came out of the research. One is that your thought leadership needs to be relevant to your target audience. It needs to be distinctive from what other people are saying, and it needs to be demonstrably true. And research can help with all those things. Relevance in terms of understanding the audience you're speaking to and the sorts of issues that are forefront in their mind. Distinctive, again, research can help you find out what angles haven't been explored before, what things would be particularly interesting. And demonstrably true, well, research is great at that. One of the things that the research turned up is one of the least liked things about thought leadership is unsubstantiated opinion. If you've got research where you say we've spoken to 100 people or 500 people or however many people it is who are your peers and they think X about your product or your challenge or your situation, then that is much more credible than just saying I reckon X is true.
Yeah, absolutely. And that credibility, I suppose, means that you can also get referenced from other articles, and then you get kind of inbound links and increases your authority on Google and all of that good stuff as well, I suppose.
Yep, certainly. Again, what the research showed was that readers are looking for you to draw together interesting, relevant threads for them rather than just a single viewpoint that's unsubstantiated. And research can help you do that in a number of different ways.
Okay, so what kind of techniques do you use to do that, get that insight out of people?
Well, there's two main ones. One is qualitative research, where we're talking to people normally over the phone in depth to try and tease out particular quotes or ideas. And there's quantitative, where we're looking for a reasonable size sample that gives us data that we could then slice and dice in terms of who thinks what about what particular product or what particular opportunity.
Right, and the former of those sounds like the more expensive one. Is that fair to say?
They're complementary. You probably wouldn't do anything like the volume of qualitative research as you would do for quantitative. It's perfectly legitimate to do half a dozen telephone interviews with leading people in the industry and garner their thoughts and ideas and get some relevant quotes, and that's absolutely fine. But it's not okay to speak to six people and say, if five out of six of them agree that that's some stupidly high percentage of the population in general, agree that X is Y.
Sure. So that kind of low level kind of qualitative, it's about getting sound bites rather than getting statistics.
It's getting a feel for what people think and believe rather than an absolute percentage.
Okay. If the listener is someone that has kind of a limited budget or is listening from a kind of a small company, is that something that's really kind of best done by an organization like yours? Or, I mean, can they get some distance towards it themselves?
I think you can get some distance towards itself. Yeah, certainly if you have the contacts, doing some qualitative research on your own can always pay dividends just in terms of talking to people, understanding the pressure points in their business, in their field, and understanding what their approach to solving those problems are is always worthwhile. Where an agency like ours can help with those things is actually getting the contacts. If you want to talk to CTOs or CEOs or CFOs, you might want to talk to people abroad. You might want to talk to people who haven't done any business with your business previously. Then someone like us can help join the dots and ask the right questions of the right people, rather than you just spamming around LinkedIn looking for someone who will hopefully answer your questions. Similarly, in terms of quantitative research, it needn't be anything like as expensive as consumer, because generally you're talking to much smaller numbers of people. It's totally credible to have a response size of, say, 100, particularly where you're looking at a niche audience where there aren't that many people in your target audience. We often give the example of, if you wanted to do a quantitative research amongst people who've walked on the moon, there's only 12 people in the respondent universe and only 10 of them are still with us. So it's horses for courses in terms of respondent size, really.
Sure. And that's interesting. So I think one of the things that we talk about a lot when we're talking about producing content is, you know, making it that really, really focused on one particular audience type. And that's something where I suppose the more focused you are on who your reader is, you know, or who you are researching, then the easier it is to do some research that actually means something, I guess.
Yeah, I think it comes back to the three key strands we talked about at the opening: relevance, distinctiveness, and truth. And yeah, relevance is absolutely tied to who you're trying to reach out to. You're more likely to get traction with the people you're looking to attract by speaking directly to them and demonstrating you understand what their challenges are. A broad-based piece is less likely to get direct traction.
Okay, so if our listener then is interested in putting together some thought leadership research, maybe of their own to start with, to give it a go, are there any tips you could give them on from your experience on doing some research that will then translate into a great piece of thought leadership content later?
Certainly. Need to bear in mind that these people are time short, time poor. Mm-hmm. So generally, they tell us that articles of around 600 to 800 words are fine. Mm-hmm. But I think it was Winston Churchill who said to his civil servants, "I don't want to read anything that's longer than the single page of A4 because I'm too busy to take in anything longer than that." Mm-hmm. And 600 to 800 words should be fine for you to communicate that you understand their challenge, you have some authentic ideas about what their potential solution might be, and leave the door open for them to talking to you in greater depth about what those answers might be, which ultimately, I guess, is what you want to do, is generate traction. You want to generate leads and conversations beyond the thought leadership itself. So sure. Keep it succinct. Mm-hmm. The other research also told us that many of the C-suite are looking for something that will give them a competitive edge. So if the theme of your research is something that will help them do just that, then it's more likely to be read. Mm-hmm. They welcome robust opinions, but only when the opinions are backed up by robust data. Mm-hmm. And they hate robust opinions that are pure conjecture. So if you can keep your information succinct and relevant and demonstrably true, then you're far more likely to get cut through.
Great. Thank you. That's really helpful. And if they were going about research, is there any advice you could give them on setting up the research itself in order to kind of ask good questions?
You have to ask the questions neutrally. It might be that you put some quite incendiary opinions in front of them. You might be researching around blockchain, for example, and you want a polarized opinion. And so you might ask them to what extent you agree or disagree with the statement that blockchain is the biggest white elephant in the history of IT. As long as you ask the question in the terms of to what extent do you agree or disagree with, then you're going to get a balanced response. If you say, ask a leading question, you would agree, wouldn't you? Then you're going to skew the responses more than perhaps you should. So it's okay to put incendiary statements in front of people because they're more likely to get a strong response. But you do have to make sure the questions themselves are posed in a balanced way.
Oh, I could imagine having some fun with that. That's a really interesting thought. Simon, while you have the ear of B2B marketers and copywriters around the world, is there anything that you'd like to add, or is there anywhere in particular that people can or should get hold of you if they want more information?
Sure. If you want a copy of the research that we've done into the C-suite and how they consume thought leadership and where and why and when, drop me a line on simon@coleman-parkes.co.uk. I'll happily send you a copy.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you. That's very kind. Simon, thank you very much for your time. That is really, really helpful.
And thank you for asking me.
So that's the why and the how of research. Research? Research? Who knows?
Do you do
the first syllable or the second?
I don't know. I'm worried now. I think I use both, depending on the rest of the sentence.
Well, the listener will have to Listen out for that one. But also, Simon shared a little bit about how you might think about presenting it in your content too. So, Fiona, what did you think about Simon's recommendations?
So what I was most interested in, I think, and I'm quite glad that someone's done this research or research and come up with an answer, is that C-level executives, when you're writing content for them, like opinion to be backed up with evidence and factual statistics and things that they can use to justify a business decision. Because, you know, a lot of thought leadership we see and sometimes that we're asked to do is basically opinion. And, it, you know, there's a lot been said in recent times about, oh, you need to sort of make your B2B content emotional, but there does need to be that rational kind of justification in there as well. So you need both. And that's, I think that's what Simon was saying. You know, people like robust opinion as long as it's backed up with robust evidence.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, especially in a world now where everybody wants to be a thought leader, you know, to actually, you know, facts do still trump opinions, I think.
Yeah, otherwise you're just a bit of a blowhard, aren't you, if it's just your opinion. So
yeah, absolutely. And do you think that's just in general, or, you know, possibly with some of the personas and the audience types that we write for, perhaps? You know, so we're writing for people who are, you know, who are often quite technical, you know, it might be a CTO or it might be an engineering audience, the kind of people that, you know, that shudder when they feel marketed to, you know, maybe they just the facts, ma'am.
Yes, well, I mean, I think some people are more interested in facts than others, but, you know, I think in the world that we operate in, everybody needs the facts to back up a decision, but also everybody's a human being. So I think, you know, there does need to be a mix of both. There's your kind of emotional argument and there's your data, your justification.
And that's the illustration of it right there, I guess, is that, you know, we can now refer to the research from Grist and Coleman Parks when we're talking to our own clients about, you know, when they go, well, why do we need to include statistics in this? You know, we now have evidence. And I think that as far as promoting your own one's own content goes, you can then make your own content kind of referenceable, by which I mean that other people are then more likely to put in links in their own content to yours and to draw other people's attention to your content when your findings support their opinion in turn.
Yeah, so but yes, it makes your content more credible and more authoritative and more likely to be used and shared. Yes, so it increases the impact of your own content.
Fiona, do we often get the opportunity to include primary research in our content that we're writing for clients, or is it mostly secondary stuff?
Well, I think we do quite a lot. So several of our clients will commission research from independent third parties, and often we're given that raw data to include. In fact, we quite often write up research reports from data that's come out of that research. So yes, we do quite often have primary research, and where we don't, we look for secondary research.
And it's a skill that nobody really talks about for a B2B copywriter, I guess, to be able to look at the data and find where the story is, to understand what the numbers mean. There's, I wouldn't go so far as to say it's data science, but, you know, it's actually, you know, it's often the writer who has to pick out where the story is among the statistics. You know, we're often not given that, are we?
It's definitely a skill. And sometimes we are given the data and asked to make a story out of it. And I think it isn't something that people should necessarily expect a writer to be able to do. So what we like to do is like get on the phone then with the client and talk through the findings and like find the story together. Because yeah, you're right. It's not something we're necessarily trained in and able to do on our own.
Yeah, it's really fun though.
It's fun if there's an interesting story there. But what we quite often find is that the client has commissioned the primary research and it either doesn't tell them what they wanted it to, or it doesn't tell them anything interesting. And sometimes that is a challenge because, you know, they still want to go ahead and talk about this research. And so it can be quite a challenge to actually extract a story from it that's not kind of apparent at first glance.
Sure. And I think, you know, a lot of what Simon was talking about is designing the research with the end product in mind. And I think sometimes that doesn't happen. And I think sometimes people are maybe worried about being too leading in that.
Yeah. It's certainly, either designing the research with the end product in mind or definitely looking at the way you phrase the questions. Because, I mean, as Simon was saying, you can ask questions in different ways. I'm not saying you should ask leading questions, but the way you phrase the question is going to have a real bearing on the data that you get back from it.
Yeah, like the thing that you said about asking something quite controversial and saying, to what extent do you agree or disagree with this statement?
Yeah, so there is a whole science there in how you should phrase the questions. And I think sometimes if you're not using a professional research firm to do that research, you can end up phrasing the questions in a way that's not going to get you anything interesting back.
Yeah, it's either way, isn't it? You can either get something that's really bland and uninteresting, or you can get something that's not statistically credible because you've led the reader. It's a difficult one. But you were saying, when we don't have the luxury of all this lovely data to swim around and have a good old number crunch with, that kind of we then sort of fall back on secondary sources.
Yeah, so 95% of the time we haven't got primary research from the client. One of the things that we always try to do in our content that we write for clients, and it in fact is one of the questions on our 15-point quality framework that we talked about in the last podcast, is have we supported the argument with evidence and facts and statistics? And so we'll always try to go out, if the client doesn't have any of their own that they like to draw upon, then we will go out and do desk research to try to find supporting evidence for what we're saying.
Yeah. Sometimes you got to know the client quite well sometimes to do that, because you can end up finding brilliant figures from places that are like, no, we don't want to acknowledge that that exists.
Yes, finding brilliant figures that from one of their competitors. Yes.
You have to be careful about that.
Yes.
So how do you go about finding those statistics?
So often for us, it's just knowing how to use Google properly, knowing how to phrase the question so you're going to find something, and then knowing how to evaluate what it is that you do find to make sure that it is credible and usable.
Sure. And then how do you tell a good source from a bad one then?
I think there is a tendency, especially when you're up against a deadline, you haven't got very much time, to just grab onto the first kind of stat that you find.
Sure.
What we do and what we train our writers to do is to follow that back to its source. So very often you'll find something reported in a publication or reported by another company on their blog, and then you have to, it looks like a really good stat, but you have to like follow it back to its source. Where did this come from? Is it from a credible organisation that it came from? Does it look like this was a statistically valid survey that they did? And is it recent? Because, that's something that we come up against a lot. We find a like really nice, juicy looking statistic and then discover that it's from like 2010 and it's like no longer relevant. Very often, actually, clients will ask us to include certain stats and findings in the content that we would judge to not be credible anymore because of that, because they're too old. So we kind of train ourselves to not look at anything that's over a year old.
Wow. So is that something where we do that, we're sort of looking out for the client? Is that more like of an ethical thing or more of a business value thing so that the reader won't then discount the content? Or is it a bit of both? Why do we do that?
I think it's both. So, we want to make sure that we are creating credible, authoritative content for mm-hmm. our clients. And it has to have, if we're using statistical evidence in it, that has to be credible. And if it's out of date, then it's not credible. And the other thing is absolutely valid as well. So we have to create something that's useful for the reader and actually gives them genuine, usable, true, factual information. And if, something's out of date, then it may no longer be true and it may not be helpful to them.
So, and maybe sometimes we have to kind of guide clients in that direction, I suppose. It's a bit like a bit like the gender say gap thing, I suppose, where actually what's good for society is also what's good for business, you know, and the quality of the content, but it's not always the obvious, easy thing. And sometimes, you know, someone, and if it's not the writer, then maybe no one else will do it, has to kind of stand up for that.
Exactly. And I think, you know, you're doing everybody a favour by doing that. You know, don't feel that you're being awkward by, you know, if you're in a position where somebody's asking you to use some statistics you think are dubious, don't think you're being awkward by going back to saying, no, look, can we look for some more credible, more fresh evidence? Because, you know, you're going to make the client look more credible and you're going to be more useful to the reader. So, you know, why not do it?
So you were talking about chasing a stat back to its source. How do we do that? If you kind of give the listener a quick crash course in that.
So that's if you're reading about it and there's a link to where it came from, you go back to the source where it came from, you look for the report that it came from. Or if you, because often they're from, you know, Forrester and Gartner, you can't get at those reports unless you want to pay 1500 quid or, you know, $5,000 to get one of those.
Which for one stat is yes, on the steep side.
Exactly. So you trace it back as far as you can to understand the context that it came from, or look for corroboration. You know, are lots of different media outlets using this same stat? Because if you only find one stat in one place and you can't really trace it back to anything, then you can't really use that. You can't really say that that's valid. So it is tracing it back as far as it can go, as far as you can go with it, and then assessing that original piece of research. You know, is it actually valid? Is this stat saying what I think it's saying? And is it still current?
Right. And so what if you've looked and you have something that, you know, a point that you want to make on the client's behalf, but you can't find anything to support it? What do you do then?
Yes. So sometimes I think, well, if there's nothing here to support this argument, then you haven't got a valid argument.
Wow. that's an interesting conversation to have with a client.
But yeah, but that's kind of a blunt way of looking at things. I mean, what I certainly try to do is I ask the client, you know, do you have anything that you use normally to back this up? Have you done any research of your own? Do you have access to any analyst research that backs this up? If so, can we sort of quote from it? You know, ask them what they would use. But, you know, if you haven't got anything, then either your client doesn't have an argument or it's something so new that nobody's done any research around it. And this is actually what I found interesting about what Simon was saying, is that you can do that qualitative research. Yeah. So you can find somebody or just find a small group of people and ask them about it. And that is something where sometimes we do some workshops with our clients where we'll ask them to put us in touch with their end customers and talk to them to get some sort of qualitative views of what's going on in the marketplace. And that can be really interesting. And you can come up with some really nice sort of anecdotal qualitative evidence there. So yes, if there's nothing quantitative, then try to get something qualitative. And I can't believe I said those two words. They're very difficult to pronounce.
Like stalactites. Anyway. Yes. And I think that was a really interesting point, because I think a lot of the time when we think about research, it's with thinking about statistics, with thinking about numbers. And if, you know, it can also just be someone who clearly knows, someone with authority to speak on an issue, saying something really cool. And, you know, actually, both of those things are valid. It's not even that the quote is just as a fallback if you haven't got a statistic. You know, the two, I think, can be really engaging. And, you know, and particularly if it's from a third party, it can kind of broaden out the appeal of the piece as well.
Definitely. And if it's from a third party that's a really credible third party, so whether it's a consultant, whether it's an analyst, or whether it's, you know, a big company or a large organisation in that sector, then it can lend validity to your argument, but also bring the story to life as well.
And that is all we have time for this month. If you have any comments or thoughts on this episode, please do email us on podcast@radix-communications.com. We're insecure like that, and it's nice to know that you're out there. You can send us a voice memo if you like, or find us on Twitter @radixcom. You can find more of our content online and sign up for monthly copywriting tips at radix-communications.com/insights. So, until next time, remember what Sir Isaac Newton said. Just because a quote's on the internet doesn't mean it's real. Goodbye.